Welcome to PD Heart, Pediatric Cardiology Today. My name is Dr. Robert Pass, and I am the host of this podcast. You've tuned in this week to the first episode of 2023, and also episode 236 of the entire series. Thank you for joining me this week. I hope everybody had a great holiday weekend and a holiday season, and we're kicking off this year with a very exciting new episode on the topic of cardiac transplantation. Just to remind you, last week we spoke about personal finance with the noted authority Paul Merriman. And for those of you with an interest in low-cost investing that's simple, easy, and sophisticated, I'd recommend you take a listen to last week's episode 235. And as I say every week, if you'd like to get in touch with me, it's easy to remember my email. It's pdheart@gmail.com. This week, as I said, we're moving on to the topic of heart transplantation, and this is an extraordinarily interesting paper. The title of the work is Partial Heart Transplantation Can Ameliorate Donor Organ Utilization. The first author of this work is Curry Sherard, and the senior author is Conrad Rajab. And this work comes to us mostly from the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina. When we're done reviewing this paper, Dr. Taufik Conrad Rajab has kindly agreed to speak with us about it. Therefore, let's move straight on to the article and then a conversation with its senior author. This week's work is not really a research paper, but rather a general, shall we say, case for the concept of partial heart transplantation, with a discussion of the problem and then how the authors believe this concept of partial heart transplantation may be a possible answer to some vexing issues in the management of some often fatal forms of congenital heart disease. The work begins with some comments about the prevalence of congenital heart disease and the fact that it is estimated that nearly 70% of congenital heart disease deaths occur in infants who are less than a year of age. They explain that the issue they are most concerned about is that of pulmonary atresia, truncus arteriosus, and aortic stenosis, and when there's a defect in an existing valve. And in those cases, a repair is the preferred approach, but sometimes there are just no techniques that are available, and replacement may be the only option. The authors review the fact that at the present time for replacement of a valve, the options are basically bioprosthetic valves, mechanical valves, or autografts, as are done in the Ross operation. The authors then proceed with a brief discussion of each of these valve replacement choices and what are, in their review, the potential benefits or disadvantages of each. In regards to mechanical valves, they make note of the fact that 16 millimeters is the smallest such valve available that is fully mechanical, and that 16 millimeters may still be too big for small children, particularly those less than a year of age. When they can be used, they're generally more durable than biological or bioprosthetic valves, but we all understand that anticoagulation is needed for these patients lifelong, which carries its own problems for the young. And of course, when it comes to children, they don't grow, and so there's a time limit on most of these valves from the perspective of growth alone in children. The authors point to the high risk for endocarditis for mechanical valves. And so, though they do provide a potentially durable, temporizing solution, mechanical valves have a number of associated downsides that most of us are well aware of. The authors then speak about bioprosthetic valves and how these are basically either xenografts or homografts. In regard to porcine or bovine xenografts, the clear benefit is the lack of need for anticoagulation, but they tend to calcify in children fairly quickly, and the authors point to a paper from over a decade ago by Susan Salib showing that stenosis requiring intervention was happening at about 6 months out from surgery, with valvular failure very common in children. The authors speak about the Melody valve and how it can spare children surgery, but also mention the higher-than-average incidence of endocarditis in these valves, which we have reviewed previously a number of times on this podcast, and the very rapid degeneration in kids who have bioprosthetic mitral valves, which are usually durable only for about 3 to 5 years. In regard to homografts, the authors note that homografts can last as long as 8 or 10 years, but they don't grow, and we all know that they can become heavily calcified in the young. The authors then review the Ross operation and how it provides many advantages for the young patient needing aortic valve replacement, and how one of the most important advantages of this operation is the manner in which the autograft will grow with the child. The other obvious advantage is avoidance of anticoagulation. However, almost all Ross patients who've had this operation very early in life will require reintervention in the future, and amongst neonates, the mortality rate can be fairly high, and it is not considered an appropriate approach if a patient has a connective tissue disorder or have a bad pulmonary valve that can't be used as an autograft. The authors then speak a bit about pediatric heart transplantation and emphasize some of the challenges of transplanting small children with a very high mortality rate of 25% on the wait list for neonates. There are many reasons for this, but the bottom line is that mortality rates for infants waiting for heart transplant is highest among kids who are less than 12 months of age. The authors then speak about the fact that a large number of potential donor organs are discarded because of high-risk characteristics of these hearts. But there are some reports showing that high-risk donor hearts may be usable, sometimes with acceptable outcomes, in pediatric patients. Pediatric transplant cardiologists and cardiac surgeons also try to accept somewhat oversized grafts, and we all are aware of ABO-incompatible heart transplantation in small children, which has helped to reduce mortality in this very young group of patients needing heart transplantation. With this as a background, the authors then speak about the concept of partial heart transplantation and how in this procedure, diseased valves could theoretically be replaced with matched orthotopic heart valves harvested from donor hearts, and importantly, they posit that healthy valves could be taken from almost any donor heart, even those that are not thought to be good candidates for orthotopic heart transplantation. They speak of how many donor hearts that might be discarded could be considered and used for this indication, and explain how the theoretical advantage would be that the valves transplanted would grow with the child and minimize the need for reoperation until the child became adult-sized. The patient would need immunosuppression until their transplanted valve was removed and replaced with a mechanical or other valve, and they speak of how a limited period of immunosuppression would likely carry lower risk for partial heart transplanted patients versus patients who've undergone a complete orthotopic heart transplantation who have a new heart lifelong and not for a limited time period. They suggest that this approach might be useful initially for pulmonary or aortic valves, but might be harder for mitral or tricuspid replacements due to the complexity of the anatomy and the subvalvular apparatus. They speak of how this might be preferable as primary operations rather than replacement and then failure of the replacement, and how we can use what we already know about some of these replacement valves and how good or bad they are to inform decisions regarding whether we should consider this form of therapy first. They explain that the valves have been shown to tolerate viability in vitro for longer than an entire heart, and they wonder if that might allow for a wider geographical catchment area for the donor material due to higher or greater viability over longer periods of time, but they admit that much more research regarding this fact is needed to confirm the suspicion of whether this is true. The authors speak of partial heart transplantation as possibly, to quote them, a bridging of the gap between infancy and the age when the child is large enough to accept an adult-sized mechanical valve while avoiding anticoagulation at young ages. They again emphasize how a partial transplant followed by eventual replacement means the avoidance of lifelong immunosuppression and the possible risks associated with this. They remind us that even though this approach might allow for the use of more donor hearts, there is still the limiting issue of availability of donors for this. And as they state, and I quote, "While in theory donors for partial heart transplantation will be more plentiful than donors for orthotopic heart transplantation, they are not ubiquitous, and some patients may face the same drawback of long waitlist times leading to high mortality." And so they conclude, "Overall, partial heart transplantation, like any method of valvular replacement in the pediatric and neonatal population, has complications, but it is a promising consideration that could address disadvantages currently existing with mechanical valves, bioprosthetic valves, and the Ross procedure, as well as the shortage of hearts for orthotopic heart transplantation. The ultimate goal of partial heart transplantation is to decrease morbidity and mortality in children necessitating valvular replacement. It has the potential to do this when compared with current methods of treatment, in large part by alleviating the burden of the donor organ shortage for orthotopic heart transplantation." Well, I hope you weren't let down too badly by this work this week, as it really has no real data to present and is something of a review as well as a look forward. This is certainly the stuff of science fiction, but some of you may have seen the reports from Duke a few months ago in the lay press about an infant who underwent this procedure. I've always wanted to present to you some of the most cutting-edge approaches on this podcast, and sometimes some of the stuff we've reviewed may not have panned out, but it is, I think, important to keep up with some of the more important concepts that are coming down the pike. There are certainly many, many questions that arise in one's mind, including what Unos thinks about this approach, and what the transplantation world thinks about it. And why can bad hearts be used? And is there evidence for this approach with these sorts of hearts? These are amongst the many questions that I think we should think about and discuss with its senior author, Dr. Rajab. Taufik Conrad Rajab was educated at the University of Oxford and the University of Cambridge. He completed residencies in general surgery and cardiothoracic surgery at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and a research fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery at the Massachusetts General Hospital, as well as a clinical fellowship in congenital cardiac surgery at Children's Hospital of Colorado. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon at the Medical University of South Carolina, and it is a great pleasure to speak with him today about this interesting topic. Welcome, Dr. Rajab, to the podcast. I'm here now with Dr. Conrad Rajab from Medical University of South Carolina. Dr. Rajab, thank you so much for joining us this week on the podcast.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Real pleasure to have you. I have to say, this is definitely one of the most innovative concepts that we've discussed on the podcast in the recent past. Partial heart transplantation, as you describe in your paper, could theoretically ameliorate the transplant list wait times by allowing some patients to have a valvular replacement rather than actually a total heart replacement. I'm wondering if you could share with the audience who amongst congenital heart patients who are presently undergoing valvular repairs who might actually benefit not from a reparative operation, but instead a partial heart transplant replacement as a primary repair or replacement. And in similar vein, who could get this form of therapy rather than a full heart transplant?
I think the main indication for partial heart transplant is whenever you need a growing heart valve replacement. People have been working on growing heart valve replacements for decades with tissue engineering, mechanical engineering, and all of those have failed in clinical translation. Partial heart transplantation is the first clinically successful growing heart valve replacement. And the strongest indication for this that I see is in neonates who need a systemic outflow valve replacement and where the Ross operation is not an option. Mm-hmm. Because at the moment, we do not have any good options for those patients. They can get a homograft, but they outgrow these homografts within weeks to months. And if the Ross operation is not an option, really the only other thing you can do is a full heart transplant. And So in this case, there's a strong indication for partial heart transplantation. In other cases, there are less strong indications because the advantage of a growing heart valve replacement has to be balanced with the risks of immunosuppression. And so depending on how you adjudicate this balance, you may want to do a partial heart transplant in neonates with RB2PA conduits. Currently, those don't grow. By using a partial heart transplant for the RB2PA conduit, it would grow, but it would be at the, at the risk of immune suppression. And then the final indication would be a durable heart valve for older patients, because partial heart transplants are expected to last a lifetime, because the valves are living and self-repairing. Just like the outflow valves in orthotopic or full heart transplants almost never fail, we expect that a partial heart transplant also would not fail. So you had a recent podcast on pregnant women with aortic valve replacements. Imagine you have a young woman who is planning to have kids in 5 or 6 years.
Yes.
If you give her a mechanical aortic valve, she needs to be on Coumadin, which makes the pregnancy difficult. If you give her a biological valve, it may degenerate within 5 years by the time she actually wants to become pregnant. You could do a partial heart transplant and immune suppress this patient. The immunosuppression keeps the valve alive, allows it to self-repair, and then when she actually wants to become pregnant, you can stop the immunosuppression, and then the partial heart transplant would be no different from a homograft.
I see.
She could have the child and then a transcatheter valve.
Very interesting. Or she could have the child, I guess, and then go back on. Could you go back on immunosuppression? I guess the valve would probably no longer respond to that. But that's a much higher level immunology question than I think either of us are probably able to comment on, especially since it's never actually been done. But that's very, very interesting, Conrad. You know, one of the theoretical benefits of this approach is the ability to accept for transplantation hearts that would not actually ideally be chosen for a full heart transplant by our transplant cardiologists and cardiac surgeons for multiple different reasons.
I'm wondering if you could share with us what sorts of hearts might be usable for this indication of partial heart transplant that we would not typically use in other circumstances that we would reject.
That's a great question, because one of the main limiting factors for partial heart transplantation is availability of donor hearts. So where could those donor hearts come from? And we identified a number of sources. So far, the donor hearts we used for clinical partial heart transplantation were DCD hearts. As you know, donation after cardiac death has biological and ethical limitations for heart transplantation. Donation after cardiac death is defined as irreversible cardiovascular collapse. So if you then transplant a full heart and resuscitate that heart, obviously there was no irreversible cardiac arrest. So and some people argue that this invalidates the declaration of DCD death. Of course, if you only use the outflow valve or any of the valves for partial heart transplant, these ethical concerns would not apply and you can use DCD donor hearts. Similarly, if you have a DCD donor heart where the progression to cardiac death is slow, where it takes some time for asystole to occur, there's a non-perfusing rhythm, but you cannot yet declare the patient dead. During that non-perfusing rhythm, there's ischemic damage to the heart, and many people would be concerned to use such a heart for an orthotopic heart transplant. Obviously, you could use those for partial heart transplantation.
I see.
And then yet another source would be DBD hearts, donation after brain dead hearts, that have poor ventricular function but adequate valves. You would never transplant a heart with poor ventricular function, but you would never transplant a heart for an orthotopic heart transplant with poor ventricular function, but you could definitely use that for a partial heart transplant.
I see. And these are hearts that presently we would not use, and so that would be the pool, I guess, from which one could theoretically get these hearts, I suppose.
Correct. And then any heart cannot be placed for an orthotopic heart transplant because there's currently no adequate recipient within the region, that's another source for partial heart transplants.
Yes, and I thought it was very interesting how you talked about the possibility that the valves might last longer on ice than a typical orthotopic heart transplant donor heart, and how that might actually enhance the pool of donors because of the ability to go farther, I suppose, because of a longer ischemic time that might, according to what you wrote, I guess that still hasn't actually been proven, but that is a theoretical potential benefit also, isn't it, that they can potentially stay on ice longer, the valves.
That is correct. So we are studying the immunobiology of partial heart transplantation in piglets and rodents, and what we found is that the acceptable cold ischemia time for partial heart transplants is much longer than orthotopic heart transplants. And if you think about it, if you transplant a heart orthotopically, it needs to immediately perform work with high metabolic activity. If the heart does not work immediately, you come out on ECMO and you're in a lot of trouble.
Yes.
Whereas the heart transplant initially doesn't have to perform any work. It just serves a structural function. What you need, though, is viability of the transplanted cells, because the viability of those cells allow the partial heart transplant to grow and allow the partial heart transplant to self-repair. And this is what distinguishes a partial heart transplant from a homograft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A homograft does not have viable cells. It does not grow. It does not self-repair.
I see. Well, very big difference, of course. Well, here's the million-dollar question, Conrad. Can you share with us the actual present world experience with this approach in humans, or even in animal experimentation? You just hinted a little bit about your animal experiments. I remember maybe watching the news one night and seeing something about this happening at Duke a couple of months ago, and your paper is really sort of more of a conceptual paper more than anything else, but What is the world's experience in this now? How excited should we get?
Yes, that is a great question. So we have experience in dozens of piglets where we did partial heart transplantation, where we proved growth, and we're studying the transplant immunobiology of partial heart transplantation. Hmm. And based on this, Joe Turek led the first clinical heart transplantation, partial heart transplantation at Duke University. So we collaborated. I procured a DCD heart and brought it to Duke, and he then led the implant partial heart transplantation operation. This was a baby with truncus arteriosus and severely insufficient truncal valve. Hmm. Obviously, Ross operation is not feasible in a truncus. You don't have a pulmonary valve. And repair of that truncal valve was not possible either. The leaflets were very dysplastic, foreshortened, thickened. So without partial heart transplantation, the only other option would have been a homograft in the systemic position. And we know that children outgrow those within months. So that then requires multiple subsequent morbid reoperations to upsize the homografts over and over until you can implant a adult-size heart transplant. And we looked at the mortality for homograft valve replacement in truncus arteriosus in neonates, and it's 50%. What we found. In contrast, by doing a partial heart transplant, this child now has a viable, living, and growing valve, both in the aortic and the pulmonary position. Joe used both valves to reconstruct the respective outflow tracts. The patient is fully immune suppressed, just like a heart transplant recipient. And all the echoes so far show excellent function and growth of those valves as expected. That was the world's first partial heart transplant. And since then, Joe has done another one, also a patient with truncus. In this case, he was able to repair the truncal valve and used a viable pulmonary artery from a donor heart and used the partial heart transplant for the right ventricle to pulmonary artery conduit. Hmm. That's the other weak spot, you know, the other weakness of neonatal truncal valve repair is that you implant a homograft in the pulmonary position. Children also outgrow those, not as quickly as in the systemic position, but they also do. So the second partial heart transplant that Joe did was a pulmonary valve partial heart transplant. And I know that other universities are looking at that. The University of Colorado, under the leadership of James Jaggers, has a patient. I know that Columbia is looking at a patient, but I don't know if those... We have a patient here at MUSC who we are currently working up for partial heart transplant, but I don't know whether those other partial heart transplants have actually occurred yet.
Yeah, I have to say, I'd be interested to know what the ethical board had to say about doing a partial heart transplant for a pulmonary valve replacement. Although I think we all know that the homografts and truncus always seem to become problematic fairly early. I don't think it's as serious a problem in general as the aortic valve. I think the aortic valve to me seems like a pretty reasonable choice for that, but I guess we'll see, and maybe one day that will become the treatment of choice. Who knows? Things change, but very interesting, no doubt. I was wondering if you could speak to why technically this approach would not be such a great idea, in your view, at least at this time, for AV valve replacement. Instead, we've been talking about semilunar valve replacement, but it seems like AV valves may be a little more complicated.
It's technically more complicated because the AV valve has a subvalvar apparatus with papillary muscles. So in order to transplant those valves, you'd have to reimplant the papillary muscles, which is technically a more difficult operation. We thought about doing it, and we thought about trying it in our piglets, but we're not there yet. Our main focus so far has been on the outflow valves. And then other indications could be pulmonary atresia, TED pulmonary atresia, where you have to reconstruct not only the valves, but also the branch pulmonary arteries. You could use donor tissue for those. Those would grow as well. But for the AV valves, we think that is technically the most difficult operation.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, given where we stand in this research for this therapy, I'm wondering, does UNOS have any policies or procedures for this form of organ usage? At the present time, are you do you get these organs through the same organization, UNOS, that you would get a heart transplant, a full orthotopic heart transplant? Are you limited only to, for lack of a better term, bad organs that no one else will want for a full heart transplant? How does one go about getting this very critical tissue and rare tissue?
That is correct. So that is currently there's no defined process to do this. Joe Turek and I have started conversations with UNOS and the organ procurement organizations in South Carolina and North Carolina. And at the moment, we're not able to use any heart that has a potential orthotopic heart transplant recipient. So you can only use hearts that are not used for orthotopic heart transplant. We were thinking about listing a patient for a full heart transplant, orthotopic heart transplant, and then just using part of it, because both are life-saving procedures. But UNOS disagreed with that. And our next goal in the clinical translation of this experimental procedure is to build structures so that you don't have to move mountains every time you want to do a partial heart transplant, so that there are protocols in place and possibly a marketplace where potential donor hearts can be identified and listed and matched with recipients. And Joe Turek and I are working on that right now, and we've made good progress. So I'm hoping that we can clear a path and make it easier for anyone else in the future who wants to do this operation or for one of their patients.
I see. Well, for those in the audience, Dr. Rajab was really nice to agree to speak to me pretty late on Monday evening. So I'm going to wrap this up with a final question, and that was whether there was any evidence that ABO incompatibility might be less of an issue if you're transplanting only a part of the heart rather than the entire heart, because I was just thinking in terms of ease of getting organs or parts of organs, it might be easier if you were able to do ABO incompatible transplant for this. Do we have any information about how important this this issue might be for this type of heart transplant?
Yes, so the evidence that we have from our animal experiments and from the literature on homovital grafts is that heart valves may be immune privileged compared to other parts of the heart. If you have an orthotopic heart transplant at end of life, almost never is the aortic or the pulmonary valve involved. Even in fulminant rejection, the function of the outflow valves in orthotopic heart transplants is almost fine. We did experiments where we heterotopically transplanted valves in mismatched animals, and we found that the immune rejection to the valves is less than the immune rejection to myocardium. And when you think about it, infections of the heart valves are rarely cleared without surgery. The main surgery that we do for infective endocarditis is on the valve. So there is some evidence that the heart valves are immunoprivileged, and if that's the case, then most likely partial heart transplants could be done across ABO barriers, even in older children, could be done with lower levels of immunosuppression. And in the worst-case scenario, if you were to stop immunosuppression or if the immunosuppression would not work, you would end up with a homograft. Homografts come from donors. They are not ABO matched, and they work just fine. Unfortunately, they don't grow.
Right, right. And they don't have as much longevity, of course, as what you're projecting from this. Well, of course, I think it's important to note that all of this is a little theoretical, right? We only have, to our knowledge, based on this conversation, two patients on the planet Earth right now that we're at least aware of. Maybe there's another one or two who've had this done, and still only a bunch of pigs. But really extraordinarily interesting and potentially a game-changing approach to the management of multiple forms of congenital heart disease. Dr. Rajab, I really appreciate your spending time with us this week, and I very much appreciate your paper. Congratulations to you and your co-authors in just putting this concept out there for us to discuss and think about. I think this is really I'm very excited to see in what direction this path of endeavor goes over time. So thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to be with you tonight.
Thank you.
Well, I think we stumbled on quite an extraordinary topic to kick off 2023 in discussing what is really a mind-blowing approach. As we just discussed, it seems clear that there are many, many aspects of this approach from both a medical and ethical perspective that need to be ironed out. But there seems to be some rationale to consider this, and I'm excited to see how Dr. Rajab's experiments proceed, and also interested to hear how the rare patients who've been treated in this manner do. This is clearly a topic for which there is definitely a lot more that we do not know than what we do, and there remains in my mind a number of ethical questions that need review. But it is certainly exciting to envision a day when this may enter more fully into our surgical armamentarium. I wish to thank Dr. Rajab for taking time out this week to flesh out this very innovative and novel approach for us all. To conclude our first episode of PD Heart, Pediatric Cardiology Today of 2023, we end with the beautiful and famous sextet from Act Two of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, and we hear a world-class golden age group of singers from way back in 1959 in Giuseppe Di Stefano, Ettore Bastianini, Renata Scotto, and others in a wonderful performance led by Nino Sanzogno. Thank you for joining us for this 236th episode, and thanks once again to our guest. I wish you all a wonderful week and year ahead. Yeah.